Welcome to episode 129 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Alphabet Soup. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uosa, all bundled up here for the winter edition.
Yes, yeah, good gaming weather. It's pretty chilly here in Vancouver. No snow yet. We'll see if we get that over the Christmas break.
Yeah, we don't always have white Christmas.
Always a bit of a coin flip.
Yeah, I mean, it's Canada, but it's still Western Canada, so we're not guaranteed to have the white stuff.
Yeah, usually just the slippery stuff.
There you go. Yes, okay, so back for another episode, episode 129. We're in our new kind of modified new format, three segments, but it's all fairly loose, just like a light intro, more meatier middle topics, and then an off-topic topic at the end.
Yeah, we'll see. We basically follow where the interest takes us. So, as always, covering a very eclectic range of games and gaming-related topics. So, we'll kick off with the appetizer and some sort of news and games-adjacent goings-on. What's on your radar this week, Mark?
Yeah, it's actually been a pretty eventful week. I think, like, some weeks aren't, some weeks are. There's a lot to cover, so I'll just, like, mention a smattering of things. And if you don't hear us speak about a news topic, it's probably because it's not that important to us.
We don't have anything to add to it.
Yeah, exactly. So many of these things have been covered so well elsewhere. So I'm going to cover some kind of businessy business, get it out of the way. Embracer-owned Eidos Montreal studio, who makes Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it because we covered that game in the past.
Early episodes, yeah.
Exactly. So that was, I think we had a generally positive opinion of that game. And Eidos Montreal has done some games that I've enjoyed in the past, like some of the Deus Ex games.
Did they do some Tomb Raider? Am I misremembering?
Yeah, Eidos definitely, you know, has access to that catalog. I don't know if it's specifically Montreal that did it, but you know, they've done some good things in the past, maybe not so many notable things recently other than Guardians, but there was some layoffs there, so sad to see that happen. Of course, Saudi Arabia, their sovereign wealth fund, apparently owns 93.4% of EA games now.
Yep.
After the buyout. We knew that buyout happened, just like the details weren't super clear. Of course, what's his name? Trump's son-in-law is also involved in that as well, Kushner.
Yes, right.
So not much to say there, except that regime hasn't been, let's just say, very good with certain topics. You know, LGBT topics, equality in Saudi Arabia is not where it could be in other countries. So we're hoping that this isn't going to have negative effects on the subject matter of games that EA publishes. I don't know. There's been some skeevy things going on. I think the luster on those games by that publisher is really gone for me in a lot of ways. So maybe it doesn't affect me too personally. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time I played an EA game, to be honest. I mean, I haven't followed the business dealings exactly. I'm not sure, like, what subsidiary in Saudi Arabia is owning it now. I mean, obviously, linking it, any ownership of a company like that to a, you know, a government is bad broadly, let alone Saudi Arabia. But I mean, we've seen all kinds of acquisitions and monopolies, you know, continuing to aggregate these giant companies into a smaller and smaller pot. So it's hard to say how any of this consolidation is good for anyone, really, other than those at the top. I mean, we just saw Netflix and Warner Brothers, I think it is, announcing a deal. And, like, in theory, there's supposed to be arrangements to stop the antitrust, stopping this sort of monopolization, but there's always some excuse, some loophole to be made there. So no one seems to be that interested in throwing them down.
Yeah,
I know. Exactly. It's bad out there.
Yeah, that was my next story. Netflix to buy Warner Brothers and HBO for $82.7 billion. And why that affects our podcast is, well, we cover some movies here and there, but also Warner Brothers Games, publisher of, unfortunately, a lot of Harry Potter-related games, but also Lord of the Rings and other media properties
as well. What was that, Looney Tunes, Smash Brothers game? I forget.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but hey, they're happy to shelve their own Looney Tunes movies without those ever reaching the general public either. So lots of shady biz from that side as well. Anyways, those three kind of business acquisition moves are kind of a bundle. I'm just going to put them out there and as just signs of just kind of like dangerous movements in our the industry that we follow.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had time to research those specific stories. It's like this business is, this bad business news is just coming out constant stream these days. I don't have anything specific to add to that other than, as I said, it's bad for business, it's bad for art, it's bad for the consumer. Other than the few people selecting their stacks of money at the top, I'm not sure who is the winner here, really.
Yeah, the only winners are, I guess, shareholders of these various corporations. I guess just because I'm on a roll and I'm getting these news stories out there quickly, I'm just going to mention one more, and then I have a one more positive piece of news I'll cover later. Sony / PlayStation has been sharing some AI-generated PSN avatar icons as part of their, I think it was like a advent calendar kind of campaign related to the holidays. So not mission critical stuff like within a game itself, but still not a optimistic, not a positive move for, you know, an industry that relies so much on creativity, visual artists. It's just a bad look.
I mean, I didn't see this, to be honest, but as with all things AI, if you're not going to bother putting in any effort, why bother at all? Like, it's just a complete token arbitrary gesture to making content for the sake of it. Like, there's absolutely bare bones, bottom of the barrel stuff there.
Exactly. If a human, they didn't bother to hire a human with skill to make it, then why bother sharing it around for customers to use? Well, they did it because it's free. But these are kind of bummer stories. I did mention I have something positive, but why don't you maybe tell us something?
Yeah, I guess I'll continue the bummer stream here. We've spoken a little bit about some various stories of censorship, largely in regards to payment providers recently. But there's one story that was breaking last episode. I didn't quite have enough time to dig into it, but has developed since then. A game called Horses by Studio Santa Ragioni, I guess you pronounce that, is basically came out this last week, but the studio announced that it had been banned from Steam, basically, for reasons unknown. I mean, this is a fairly niche game. They've come out with a few small games like Saturnalia, Mirror Moon EP that I'm not particularly familiar with. And basically, they're playing, I mean, as you can tell from the trailer, if you watch this, this is a game playing with very sensitive themes of slavery and abuse and exploitation. It doesn't hide from that. It's quite explicit about it. Most people would call it sort of an artsy game or art house sort of vibe. By most accounts, it's not a particularly nuanced or even a good game, but it has created a lot of conversation about the nature of censorship. And I mean, obviously we were talking with in regards to the sort of Visa, MasterCard censorship. I mean, it's not even just a matter of what is banned and what themes and topics are banned, but it really does create this cooling effect, especially when it's vague, no reason given bannings like this. It just means a lot of devs, a lot of publishers are going to be like wary to publish anything that's seen to be off the beaten path at all. You know what I mean? It just has this really cooling effect on the nature of art and what messages people can try and get out there. So not to say much about specific about this game in itself, but I mean, Steam said banned this game without any reason or recourse. Epic had also banned it as last reporting, and Humble had temporarily banned it before reinstating it, it seems. And I know it's strange that they all banned it sort of fairly close to each other. It does feel a little bit like, if not like some kind of larger campaign, or at least some kind of fear of a campaign from the hires up at these publishers. I mean, look, Valve, no stranger to censorship, but in their own games. Living in Australia, we experienced Left 4 Dead 2 was heavily censored by the government there. They had to like basically change the game to like take out various assets to re-release the game in Australia and Germany, I think it was. You know, so you think Steam, Valve would be a little more sensitive to like censoring, banning games with like no reason or recourse there, but it's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm not going to add anything to this topic because it's been covered very well recently on Aftermath Radio. Aftermath Hours, I think it's called, the show from Aftermath, the independent news source, had a really good conversation talking about it on their December 5th episode, so go check that out. Very worthy podcast to listen to. They've covered all the angles very well and in a lot of detail, so listen to it there. I'll just say that this is, you know, a worrying trend in addition to those payment gateway related censoring and pulling of sensitive games. You know, the one quote I recall from that Aftermath Hours episode is that art happens on Steam by accident if it manages to sneak out. It's not part of their mission objective. It's to sell products. And, you know, it's hard to sell products when you might trigger someone who's particularly sensitive about these sorts of things. So maybe it might be a good idea to look for some alternative sources to acquire your games, if at all possible.
I mean, Steam has always taken a very soft approach to moderation. I mean, just look at any on any given day, go to the newest games on Steam. Chances are 90% of them will be either AI slop or some kind of porn visual novel game. Like, they're not adverse to, like, you know, adult material on the platform. Something specific here has obviously spooked them, it seems, and it seems like a real double standard, basically. I mean, you see so many other games dealing with sensitive topics, whether it's advocating for them is a different story. Art is complicated in how it represents these things. I mean, not to get into the whole video games art, but this feels like there's such a limited understanding of what that even means in this industry right now, and how more challenging approaches to these topics can be advocated for.
Yeah, I'm being done with talking about that topic because it's covered very well elsewhere. One bit of positive news that I just stumbled upon. It's not really news, I guess. I guess it is new because it's a new YouTube channel that I stumbled upon. This YouTube channel is called Catalog. Simply, and they are a channel about a month or two old, and they're focusing on the history of primarily JRPGs, it looks like, some other stuff as well, but mostly JRPGs, which are of interest to, you know, you and me both, I think, and potentially our listeners as well. So they had a very good video series deep dive on Phantasy Star, the whole series, generally the first entry in the topic, but they covered like the whole history of it, and it's very well researched and narrated, and it follows along similar lines of what we read in that book Fight Magic Items, which maybe we'll be talking about a little bit later, but with additional interesting anecdotes about development history, some of the additional key players, and technical notes, even like some of the, like, restrictions, limitations on the hardware, and some technical workarounds that they've come out with. And they don't just cover Phantasy Star, they also cover a series like Megami Tensei. Not just Shin Megami Tensei, because Shin Megami Tensei is actually the second game in that series, and there are two games called Megami Tensei as well that came out in the same year initially. They also covered the East series. So these are some series that are like less talked about than the, you know, more well-known ones like your Dragon Quest and your Fantasy and your Final Fantasies. So I have always been fascinated about these titles, wanted to know more about them and know more about early video game history, early console game history, and this is a great place to do it. The episodes are about 35 minutes or so, and they're a great depth, enough to get you interested in learning more about these topics, and just really shows you more than you might have known about these game series that you love. So I really enjoyed that. That's Catalog, a YouTube channel that I just discovered.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. I've definitely been interested in learning more about the Phantasy Star series. I'll have more to talk about that maybe next episode. But as we've been talking recently about Final Fantasy, I mean, it's been interesting exploring some of these older games. And even if they are more accessible in various forms, like the remasters and fan translations, it is easy to miss a lot of the context in their original development, the original versions. So it's always interesting to see experts dig into their development and history and pull apart some of the missing pieces that you don't necessarily see when you play a pixel remaster.
Yeah, and watching a few of these videos in a row, I basically watched all of those that I mentioned in about a week or so, it was interesting to see, like, things you don't really consider. I think I mentioned when I went to the Nintendo Museum in Kyoto, I was fascinated by, they showed the relative sales percentages of the hardware in the various regions around the world. Those are things I never really consider, right? Because you grow up in one place, you always just think, oh, well, this system was really popular. How could it not have been a success? It turns out it was only popular in one region, and it was a real bomb in another. For instance, I have a very distinct memory of visiting Japan in my youth. Maybe I was 8 or 10 or something like that, and I was going to like a shopping center and seeing all these cool console products, some of which I'd known, some of which had different names. You know, the Sega Genesis was called the Mega Drive in Japan, and the TurboGrafx was called the PC Engine. And I was really interested in Genesis games, so I was like, oh, I want to see more of the Sega Mega Drive, because I think the games were compatible, like the cartridges were the same size, which wasn't always the case. But my uncle was saying to me, are you really interested in the Sega? But the PC Engine is way more popular. And he was right. Because in Japan, the PC Engine was way more popular, but the TurboGrafx was perennially the third most popular system at that time over here in North America. And you yourself grew up in Australia, which is another different region, so you probably had a different experience yourself.
The names of the equivalent consoles were completely different over there. Yeah, I'm not sure what the equivalents are exactly. But I mean, so much of it is marketing or the perception of what would be popular. Some products never get released in certain markets at all. Yeah.
Yeah, and now games are so globalized. Things have simultaneous global releases. And markets like the United States are much, much more important for Japan. Japanese-made games even, which a lot of these happen to be. So, anyways, suffice it to say, I was very fascinated by those documentary videos from Catalog.
Very cool. I'll definitely check those out myself. One final bit of more positive news myself, talking about a crowdsourced project that's out right now. We've been talking recently about a couple of projects that played with a standard deck of cards and basically hacking them and repurposing standard card decks. There's another project that's playing with a very similar theme. This is called Card Drives by Michael Elliott, who I believe is a local Vancouver-based. And so this is basically, I mean, as you can imagine with the hacking a deck of cards, very appropriate cyberpunk theme. Basically going through various nodes in a network, and as you do so, having to play basically play poker hands, similar to Balatro. And as you do so, you have the chance to sort of change up some of the cards, like modify them, cut them, sticker over them, scribble on them, do various modifications to like improve your chances of hitting some of these poker hands as you go. I actually played through, there is a demo version available on itch.io. I'll put the links in the show notes. I played a couple of rounds of the demo. It's a little strange because this is, I mean, it calls itself a TTRPG, but it's really one of these liminal spaces between like board games and TTRPGs, or like very much more mechanical driven, but through the lens of a more thematic set of rules rather than what we might be used to in the board game space. So there's a little bit of obscurity in the rules that I need to clarify. Like it's not clear what the limits of modifying your cards are. Can you just invent a whole new suit with a unique power and make up your own rules? Or is it just like turning a 4 into a 5? It's not particularly clear. But if you're willing to navigate a little more ambiguity, as a lot of role players are, and figure that out as you go and improvise a little bit, then it's fascinating concepts. As I said, like, I love the idea of playing with the standard deck of cards and hacking it. It is a little strange because obviously as soon as you start stickering it, it makes it very hard to shuffle. And so it feels like I should be using sleeves, but card sleeves are the least cyberpunk thing there is, as you can imagine. So I feel like you have to just have the bent cards that are just going to be completely like unbalanced in how you shuffle and just roll with that. But yeah, it's an interesting concept. I'm curious to see how that develops. It's Card Drives. It's on Kickstarter right now.
Maybe they should have gone with like a Fallout theme or something where they're like cobbling together decks with mismatched cards from various sources. That might have gone over well.
Well, it's like one of the things that you do is you add ice cards into your deck that will sort of gunk up the thing. And it's basically suggested that you could just use the jokers, or you could use cards from other decks of like other sets. I've got a couple of Magic cards, Netrunner cards in there. Thankfully, they're all about the same size, but you can just like throw a whole bunch of miscellaneous stuff in there, and you very quickly end up with a very hodgepodge, scrapped together piece of card deck.
Nice. All right. What do you think, Daniel? Should we move into our main topics?
Absolutely. Lots of games to discuss.
Cool. Yeah, I have a couple games. You want to start us off, or shall I?
Yeah, I mean, I'll kick us off quickly, just because this first one pivots into a little bit what you were just discussing about in, you know, games hitting different markets, because this is one that was not released in the West until 2003. Just last episode, you were talking about Horonobu Sakaguchi, who more recently published Fantasian, was it? The game you were discussing last week.
Yep.
But going right back to the beginning, I've been playing Final Fantasy II, which he directed. This was published and developed by Square, minus Enix, and originally came out in Japan in 1988. As I said, did not come out in Europe and the US until 2003 on the PlayStation. And then I think shortly followed by the Game Boy Advance Dawn of Souls that we were talking about. We reviewed the first Final Fantasy recently, and compared our thoughts on that. So yeah, since then I have played Final Fantasy II. I didn't want to do like a whole episode long review, but just wanted to get out a few brief thoughts. Mark, have you played this at all?
No, I haven't gotten around to 2 yet. I bought the Pixel Remaster fairly recently, so it's definitely in there, but no, my experience has mostly been with 1, 2, and 3, as they were called in North America, which is actually 1, 4, and 6, and of course the later ones as well. But no, I'm happy to hear more.
So I have been playing the Pixel Remastered version of this, to be clear, and it's immediately apparent that this is much more of a Final Fantasy game. So many of the touchstones are here now, a lot more recognizable monsters. You've got the Marlboro monsters, I think the Chocobos make their first appearance here. Sid, who I think was in like the Pixel Remaster of 1, but that was like a later edition. This was the first version, the first of the original games that he was in. You've got like the Ultima spells and a lot more sort of classic touchstones here. So the story here is a lot more about human characters and like it's an evil empire and like a scrappy rebellion fighting against them. Very much more grounded than the sort of elemental evil from the first game, which I found really compelling. And you are backtracking a lot, which is a bit of a dirty word, but it really felt a strong sense of place. And you're going back and forth between these towns and talking to specifically like named characters that I thought it really did create a sense of place in this world, and like each town having its own identity. It does have like has named characters that you're talking to, but the playable characters are also named and have like a role to play in this rather than just the ciphers from the first game. And it actually starts like in media res, like it just throws you straight into a battle, which you immediately lose. And so it really is getting a sense of like using the engine and the state of play as a storytelling technique, like the forced lost battle and what that says about your characters. So that, I thought that was quite clever and innovative for its time. The most interesting thing here is that this is something of an Elder Scrolls game before the first one of those, in that A, skills you use, rather than leveling up your character, the skills you use, you get stronger in. So if you use a sword with your character, they'll get better at the sword. If you use a fire spell, they'll get better at that fire spell. The more magic points that you use, the more max magic points that a character will get. So it's really quite a very different way of approaching the character building in this game compared to the first. They're clearly willing to experiment and try new things rather than beholden to this is the way a Final Fantasy game works. Though I think they did return to the first game system after this. This was the only game that really used this system. I think it's somewhat maligned. I think it doesn't entirely work in that the customization can a little wonky. It does lead to like some theory crafting instead of min-maxing. The difficulty of this game wasn't particularly tough, so I was able to basically beat the game and just decide along the way which weapons I want this watch character to have, experiment a little bit, didn't have to think too hard about it. And it does encourage you to use spells more often, for one thing, rather than just like hoarding all your MP. You want to use your magic more often to try and increase your MP, to try and increase the potency of those spells. So you're more encouraged to use some of the less common sort of situational spells, like your cure spell or your like cure poison. You might usually use an antidote, but you actually want to use the spell here so that it gets stronger later in the game. So some interesting touches there that you're forced to engage with those. It encourages you to engage with a much wider variety of the systems here, I think, and customize your party however you like. The weird part is that the fourth character is actually a rotating spot that's filled by different NPCs. Like each part of the game, you'll have a different character join you, essentially. And for some reason, like most of them end up sacrificing themselves at one point or another. You do get to see a few different like character tropes as you'd go, but it does make it harder to like build your team when you constantly have that changing. But it is an interesting form of storytelling, and like the character that you have being part of the story and them coming and going. Obviously much later Final Fantasy games play with that a lot more, with multiple party members rotating in and out,
like Final Fantasy Tactics does that quite a lot in the early period. Is guest characters,
yes,
will come for a while, stay for a while, and then eventually they'll leave.
Exactly.
New ones will come in replacing them.
Yeah, so yeah, I quite enjoyed this. It's definitely a much more engaging story and sense of place than the first game. Well, I mean, the other reason that it is more like an Elder Scrolls game is that, for one thing, you can explore a little more. Like, it's slightly more open world. There were a couple of times where I went in one direction and very quickly hit enemies that were way above my level. Okay, no, I'm going the wrong way. Better go up this way instead. So it's a little more open-ended. But the most interesting thing was that it has like dialogue options. A certain limited number of characters will basically have a list of categories that you can choose to talk to that person about. And it's fairly linear, and like you're supposed to talk to this character about this keyword, and they'll give you a clue as to where to go next. But it does give you an extra verb for how you're interacting with the world, like actually talking to characters and puzzling out some interactions there. I think it's quite innovative for its time. It did remind me of the first Phantasy Star, which had like talk as a verb that you're doing with some of the NPCs there. So yeah, definitely feels more of a role-playing game than most of the other Final Fantasy games I've played, to be honest.
Yeah. A couple of tidbits about Final Fantasy 1 and 2. You mentioned the Dawn of Souls remade cartridge for the GBA. I own that one as well. But when I was last in Japan, just this earlier this year, in the summertime in Akihabara, I noticed that there was a 1 and 2 dual pack that came out for the Famicom. So as early as the original system, they were selling 2-in-1 in one cartridge. So that was really interesting, I thought. And I almost nearly picked that one up. One of the reasons why they did that strange naming thing for North America is basically because there was a longer delay time between when games came out in Japan and when they were localized in North America, if at all. So if you recall, you know, we've talked in the past how Famicom came out about 2 years before the NES did in North America. And a lot of the games had a similar kind of delay factor. And because RPGs had so much dialogue, a lot of the times they weren't localized because it was considerably more effort to localize these massive scripts. And Final Fantasy just made it out a couple of years later. And by the time 2 and 3, they were deciding to publish 2 and 3, that was like really, really late in the NES life cycle. In North America, Super Nintendo was almost on the horizon, and they thought, well, we're just not going to make any headway with these kind of really old looking titles if we release them in North America. So they just skipped them. And because so much time had passed, they decided to localize Final Fantasy IV into 2. But because Final Fantasy IV was the first Super Nintendo version, it felt like a serious jump. You know, the first intro scene is using that Mode 7 fake 3D technique where you're traversing the world over the airship, and it had the much more like cinematic intro sequence, and it was really felt like a next generation entry into that series. So no wonder they decided to pick that Final Fantasy V is known for introducing the job system that would appear in later games like Final Fantasy Tactics and 12 and things like that. And they decided to forego that one because they thought it was too complicated for the North American market. Another tidbit about me visiting Japan as a youth is I remember very, very distinctly visiting my cousin's house and watching them play Final Fantasy V, me having played Final Fantasy II, and being totally weirded out. It's like, whoa, they're already on 5 already. I've only just played 2. And, of course, it was using gameplay mechanisms I hadn't even considered, so that blew my mind. That's a core memory that sticks with me. And there's so many of these intricate stories that come out when you really look into the depths of video games, and it's I'm fascinated with them. As I grow older, the history of games really, really makes me happy to learn all those little tidbits.
Yeah, I'm sure at the time of their release, it would have been hard to go back to 2. Once you experience that Mode 7, 3D rendering, it's hard to go back to 2. But I think in hindsight, 2 does still have a lot to offer. It's one that I see very few people talk about, but I did really enjoy that one. I think it had a unique take on the genre, on the series, and it was the origin of a lot of the classic tropes that you'll come to see a lot more of.
Yeah, the thing I was that it just came to me that I was trying to think of was that in reading Fight Magic Items, which we will talk about later, but I'm going to start to seed in little details here, is that book really, the bulk of it is comparing the two giant series, Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest. And they most certainly kind of loom the largest in the world of JRPGs in Western audiences' minds and those in Japan. And a key distinction between Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest is that Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy, they innovate a lot more. You might think, oh, JRPGs are just so, you know, they're so formulaic. They just follow these patterns. But at some point, these patterns didn't exist because a lot of these games were being radically adapted from Western CRPGs. And so they had to create new inventions, new mechanisms, new adaptations for the console market, to the fact that you had these hardware limitations, you had to come up with new gameplay mechanisms.
And a lot of that perception is copycats as well, like all the emulators of these tropes, basically.
Yeah, precisely. And then like these large development teams would spin off, and then people that worked on Final Fantasy would go off and create their own games. But I just wanted to say, like, Final Fantasy, the series, does innovate a lot between every iteration, though they keep a lot of traditions, like some of those monster characters and gameplay mechanisms you mentioned, or story elements like the crystals. They innovate a lot more than the much more conservative and traditional Dragon Quest series. And I guess that's why there hasn't been so many entries in that series, and they hew much more closely to the old school.
Well, I have swung the pendulum back to the other end of Final Fantasy and just started playing 16, which I'll have more to say on at some point. But let's just say not all innovations are for the best.
I'd very much like to check that game out, too. Very cool. Any more thoughts on Final Fantasy 2?
No, just that it holds up. It's worth checking out if you have the time. And it doesn't take as long as some of the more modern Final Fantasies. It's like, what, 15, 20 hours?
Cool. All right. I might be talking about an RPG later, but let me talk about another oldish game. It's a remaster. I'm going to be talking about, in honor of our brand new release, that's really kind of the new hotness, I'm going to be talking about Metroid Prime Remastered. This would be the 2023 remaster on the Switch. I played it on Switch 1 of the GameCube game that was originally published in 2002. So, Metroid Prime came out in the same year as Metroid Fusion. I think Metroid Fusion for the GBA, if I'm not mistaken. And both these games came out in the same year, 8 years after the previous entry, which was Super Metroid in 1994. So that's a big gap, right? So I guess Metroid is interesting. We talked about this last episode or the episode before that. They've never really sold gangbusters, but they like kind of loom large in the minds of fans. Metroidvania, there's a reason why every other indie game is a Metroidvania, is because these games have sort of like dug themselves into the hearts and souls of game aficionados, retro game aficionados. And Hollow Knight Silksong was the hottest game of the last 4 or 5 months. And it's squarely a Metroidvania. So it's interesting to think that there was a period where people just didn't care about Metroidvanias. So I guess it was an intergenerational thing. So I've been playing Metroid Prime Remaster, and I never played it at the time, despite the fact that I own a disc in a box over there.
I tried to a couple of years after it came out. It was really hard to play because it had like a single joystick, I think. It didn't have like the dual joystick Halo console movement. It only had the single joystick, so it was a little bit clunky to play on the GameCube. I imagine it's better to play now with the remaster.
Yeah, I never played it on the GameCube either, so I have no point of comparison. But it does play quite smoothly on the Switch. I played it mostly in handheld form, so like 720p. It's not that bad because it still looks great. It's, you know, not quite cutting edge, but, you know, we all know it's an older game. But it doesn't feel like 20 years old. It looks quite serviceable. Like, it looks like a mainline Switch 1 game. There's a lot of detail going on. There's, like, very kind of, like, lush environments. There's a lot of, like, elemental effects. Like, you know, there's ice melting, and then there's fog and steam when you're moving from a cold environment to a hot kind of lava-infused one. There's a lot of technically interesting things going on in this game. But yeah, I just came about to it recently. I've been playing about 30 hours or so of it, I think. I didn't check the exact timing, actually. I could check right here. I've been playing on my Switch Lite, which is a really nice size. I like the Switch Lite a lot because it's like my nouveau PS Vita size. I think it's like really the ideal size when you hold them up side by side. They're about the same size and they're both 720p. So other things that are great about this series, well, there's a lot of firsts. It really innovated. It wasn't the first first-person shooter, but neither is it, you know, entirely a first-person shooter. Obviously, it's technically is first-person, and you do shoot things, but this isn't exactly Quake or Doom. But it's learning a lot, and it was the first-person entry in this series. So they really had to rethink a lot of aspects of this game. And I think this is a bit of a stretch, but I think this game owes a lot to the Batman Arkham Asylum games. And I'm just throwing this out there. I might be totally wrong with the years, but just any game where you have a scanning system.
Detective mode.
Every game that has a scanning system just turns into detective mode all the time. And this game has that in spades, and it kind of suffers for it. I think the first thing they teach you is to learn how to scan for things. It's in the tutorial mission. You land on this like landing pad, and you have to unlock this like force field or something by scanning elements. So it's like so critical, and they teach it to you first thing. I started playing this game, and I took a big break from it, and I came back, and I was forgetting to scan things. It's like, why are things not working? It's because you have to scan a lot. And this is probably like the biggest kind of differentiator from a traditional Metroid game, like the one on the NES or the Super Nintendo, to the first person mode. You didn't have like these hidden details in those 2D games, because those 2D games, the design language is a lot more simpler, a lot more straightforward. And I think there's at least three visualizing modes that I've unlocked so far, not including the normal mode. There's the scanning mode, and then eventually there's like this like heat vision mode, and then you get this X-ray vision mode. And you unlock them in various different orders, so I don't think that's really a spoiler there. But
these modes can often feel like a bit of a band-aid to like level design and the difficulty of perception in a 3D space. Like, well, right. Rather than create an interesting level design and make things that will be naturally highlighted, we'll just give them a scan mode, and they'll see everything easily that way.
Yeah, that's right. So because of the fact that the game discs are only so large, you only have so much development time, and there's only so many environments that you can create, they've kind of like layered worlds on top of each other through these different visualization modes. So for instance, using scanning, you find details that you didn't know about. Oh, this is an area that you can blow up with a bomb. You know, it's not so easy as seeing a different colored brick or something in a NES game. You would need some mechanism to find that sort of thing. Or they would hide these little switches, which you have to shoot with a certain weapon to power up this machine somewhere in the environment. Well, you got to switch to your heat vision mode for that. And you find the three hidden switches somewhere in the environment. And you called it a Band-Aid, and it certainly was that. You have these, like, kind of frustrating 3D platforming puzzles where maybe the platforms are fine, or maybe they're moving or something like that, but there might be, like, these monster tentacles that are coming out of the wall, and you have to shoot them or else they'll knock you out of the off of the platform. And if you don't find the next platform fast enough, or you're going to get knocked off. So I jump, climb all the way to the top of this three-story area, and I can't get through the door because I didn't shoot the three switches. So now I have to go all the way back to the bottom and all the way back up again.
It feels like a very prescribed way in which you have to solve this. It's almost like a very dynamic system. You have to follow a very strict sequence of events, basically, to solve the various puzzles and rooms, even the
definitely
combat.
Yeah, definitely in the first part of the game. I haven't finished the game, so I don't know if it's the first half or not. But let's just say the first 20 hours or so, big chunk, I felt quite linear. You're basically moving from like one upgrade to the next in a very specific fashion. And you know it's that case because you're just blocked off from everything. More things are blocked off than they are open. And this game, way back in 2002, was including that element, which I thought came from later games. Thought this was an innovation from later Metroidvanias, but it turns out they were doing it all the way back then. It was the real-time hint system. So I mentioned in Prince of Persia Lost Crown that periodically you'd get these messages, hey, we hear rumblings that there's some big guy attacking something over in this part of the map. And in Metroid Prime, they do it as like your ship is alerting you that they're having these seismic readings happening in this part, this region over here, and you better go check out this very specific spot. And I thought that was cheesy at first, but these worlds can get quite large, and you can get quite lost very easily, and these 3D environments are very difficult to navigate, especially with the awkward 3D mapping tool, which I'm glad it's there. It's got a hard job mapping a complex space in 3D in like a modular form. So kudos for them to do it. But the tool that they have takes a bit to wrap your brain around. So it's not the easiest.
These sorts of games are tricky. I mean, there were similar issues with even like the Final Fantasy and those early JRPG open worlds, and like knowing where you're supposed to go next. Oftentimes the hints are a little bit vague. And there's a fine line between giving hints that feel organic and then just having a breadcrumb of the follow the sparkly lights to your next objective, right? You want to provide a sense that you're exploring and a discoverability in these games, but like not leave the player completely lost.
Yeah, and the I know it's a hallmark of the Metroidvania genre, so I really don't have a leg on to stand here complaining about it, but these games are about following a breadcrumb of clues until you get blocked, and then narrowing down that point until you unlock an upgrade, which opens up a new path. And then you follow that breadcrumb of clues down to another upgrade, and et cetera, et cetera, and et cetera. And it's despite the fact that you're crisscrossing a map, either in 2D or 3D, it is quite linear. They expect you to go in a certain order. Well, that is true, very much true for this game, but eventually it opens up. After that 20 hour mark or so, you are just still tracking down upgrades, but you finally have the option to track down like more than once at a time. So it is possible that you could go in a different sequence order than another friend playing the same game at the same time. So in that sense, it is nice. You get that faux feeling of a open world game, you know, like the game is under your control. And this is helped by the fact that there are many, many secondary level secrets the types of secrets are the ones you would expect, even if you're an old school Metroid fan. They're the extra health missile supplies. They're the extra health packs, exactly. There's those sorts of things, the extra, you know, bomb capacity or something like that. But just finding them is its own joy, because they're not called out so heavily on the map oftentimes. Sometimes they're not called out at all. You just have to be very observant. So those are there. And at that point, the game opens up and you're a little freed up to sort of fly on your own. But the fact that you have to crisscross the map so much does get tedious. I don't know if it's because I was playing on the small screen, but having to do combat so often with those pirates that just flit about and sometimes go invisible was a little frustrating. You have a lot of hands-on experience with this title?
I said I only played like a half an hour, I think, before I gave up with the controls on the original GameCube. I've been meaning to check out the remaster at some point. I'll keep an eye out for it when it's on sale, perhaps. But I literally just today booted up the original Metroid on the NES. Yeah. I've only played like an hour or so of that. But like the tricky thing with that one is there's no map at all. So I'm actually drawing out a map on grid paper to keep track of that, which I think was pretty common back in the day.
There is a map.
Oh, yeah, there is? You do get maybe unlock it later. Okay.
Yeah, you do, like in this game, you do unlock like maps for a segment, but you do unlock maps as you go as well. Okay. So you might have to dig for it in a menu or something. I think that's the case. Anyways, positive things about this game is very true to the feel of a Metroid game. You know, I played mostly Metroid 1 and Super Metroid. 2 was on the Game Boy, but I didn't play that one a lot. And I played a smattering of the other ones in the series as well. Didn't get around to this one till just this past year or two. And I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I think there's a range of environments. Those environments are cool looking. Some are open to the sky and you see a lot of color. Some are really stark. Some are like claustrophobic underground or within the bowels of like a derelict spaceship or things like that. There are some issues to do with lighting. Like quite often you will intentionally be put in a very dark area and you might have to enable the heat vision technology, which plays out a lot like that, the filters from like a Terminator 2 movie or something like that. Or no, Predator. Predator is the one where they use the heat vision. And because it's intentionally blurry, like your eyes, as a person who has worn glasses in the past, I just feel like really disconcerted at the time. It's like, this should be clearer than it is, but it's intentionally meant to be blurry so that I guess you feel the tension of being attacked.
Yeah, it's a friction.
In the dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is intentional, but that still, the tension is there. And this game has an exceptional amount of backtracking, almost to the point of, like, frustration. But the feeling when you find a discovery, when you had a hunch and you weren't clued in so heavily, or you just figure out a puzzle that has multiple stages to it. You know, you can't fake that sort of thing. There's something about the original magic of it. And, you know, Nintendo still does it the best. The Metroid series still does it the best. And those other, you know, sometimes really, really good replicas of the formula are only really hitting as hard as the best of the Metroid series does. So I think this is well worth playing. There's a reason why. The remaster got a 10 out of 10 rating from IGN. It's just a really impeccable game, and I'm definitely going to see this one to the end. And, you know, I'm not really, like, feel like I'm missing out from playing Metroid 4, Metroid Prime 4, because I think I'm going to try and hunt out Metroid Prime 2 and 3, which don't have remakes yet.
No. Were they both on GameCube, or were they later on the Wii?
I think one of them is even on the Wii U, but don't quote me on that.
I know 3 was pretty maligned, I think. We'll see.
Well, I'll get to them eventually. Maybe they'll do a 2 and 3 repack or something like that.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Nintendo, being a company that that loves to remaster things, I don't know why they're not remastering
consistently inconsistent.
There you go. Anyways, that's all I have to say about Metroid Prime Remaster, the original, for Switch. It's great. Go play it if you haven't done it yet. You're missing out.
Excellent. Yeah, it's on my list. Waiting for one of those rare Nintendo sales. I had another game I wanted to talk about, a board game actually, but in the interest of time, I know you've got a game that you've been banking for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about I quickly wrap up the game that I've kind of been sitting on for a little while then? I did finish a game recently, and it's actually not that recently ago, but it's one that I mentioned in the past. I finished it. I'm not going to say too much about it. I don't know which episode we started talking about it, but the game is Metaphor: ReFantazio. People know that I like my JRPGs. This one I enjoyed quite a bit. I finished it after 108 hours. And by the way, that was entirely from borrowing from the library. So that
that's dedication.
Library system is very, very useful for that. I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. That game is beautiful to look at, the artistry of it all. It's very much a Persona-like, along the lines of Persona 5. But it makes some innovations of its own. I think it's superior to Persona, the last couple of entries. You know, totally different vibe because it's fantastical as opposed to modern day. But, you know, the difficulties and the challenges of that adults face in fantastical settings is more interesting than high schoolers, even though they deal with fantastical topics too. So what did I end up liking? I ended up doing a lot of optional content, I feel like. There are these three kind of optional bosses near the end of the game. I won't tell you what they are, but they were pretty challenging.
Did you manage to complete them?
I did.
Okay. I gave up on those, to be honest.
Yeah, I had to follow guides, but it was worth it. It felt really cool to be able to defeat those. And by the way, I did drop down the difficulty. This game lets you change the difficulty at any time. And for probably the first three quarters of it, I played at normal difficulty. And then at some point, I just had to drop it down to easy or less than normal. I don't know what it was.
I think I might have done that for the final boss. I don't recall exactly.
Yeah. At some point, I was like, am I going to finish this thing? I'm not going to like just abandon it. I'm going to finish it. I'll drop down the difficulty. Stop having shame about difficulty dropping. At this age, I shouldn't have any shame about those sort of thing. The thing that I felt like was a bit of a miss for me is that I don't know if they spelled it out early enough, but I didn't realize that every character had a sort of optimal Uber class. Because this game, you know, it does something which I generally like, which is it does the Final Fantasy XII thing where they let every character become any class. And I really like that. Every character kind of has like an inclination, like they have a starting class that's unique to them or that basically they have an affinity for, especially if you have social links with that character. And I wasn't able to max out the social links for every character. That I feel a little bit bummed about, but I got most of them to their end games. And I was kind of like extending the run of my play through because I wanted to max out those characters to their kind of Uber class. And they must have spelled it out at some point.
I missed it as well, but that was a real bummer for me too, because the customization and exploration of the different classes in this game is a real highlight. Experimenting with the different combinations, but then you get to the end and it's like, well, either you already happen to have the exact five classes maxed to get the super class, or you have to go grind for another 10 hours, I guess.
Yeah, I thought the last boss actually did a good job in making you kind of, not to spoil too much, but it made you swap out to different characters at certain times, or there was a benefit to doing that. So I thought that was a good, well-designed boss. I would just like to point out, anyone currently playing Metaphor, just make sure you check your character's Uber class. It's sort of near the top of the UI of which you choose their class. There's one unique class that's just for them. It's like Ultimate Dancer or something like that. Make sure you check out the requisites for that. And the requisites are actually pretty clearly spelled out. It's just that you have to level up like five classes to their max before that.
Because some of those also have their own prerequisites, right?
Exactly. So you have to plan quite a bit, and that's why my runtime ran so long. But aside from those sort of hiccups, I thought it was really worth the time, the considerable amount of time I spent in it, even though I usually get tired of games at around 40 hours. This one was just particularly smooth to play, and the characters were charming, and the world was interesting. Not perfect.
Did the story close up on a satisfying place for you?
The story was interesting because a lot of games sort of front load their story, and I feel like this game backloads a lot of the story. It's like they reveal so much right at the end that it feels like, really, this is what you were going for? And I feel like it didn't really cinch everything together, but they cinched enough together that it was a satisfactory close for me. And maybe they'll tie some things further in like a sequel, maybe like 100 years hence or something like that. They'll explain some more depth into the world. It's essentially about, it's about modern day politics, but it's trying to tell it in allegorical form.
I liked where that started. I mean, to be clear, I discussed this game in detail when I finished it several months ago. I don't recall what episode. I did really like where the game started in setting up the sort of democracy and the sort of that political system. And I think it really subverts that in a really disappointing way. The way the main, not to spoil anything, but the way the main character turns out going up against the big bad, I think that sort of deflates the whole democracy theme from the start of the game.
A lot of fantastical stories have the typical kind of like the chosen one, you know, the hero. Mm-hmm. Only you could have been the true hero rather than anyone could possibly be the hero, which is like the theme of 80% of the story just kind of gets tossed. So that's unfortunate, but maybe they can rectify that in a future version. I mean, I'm not going to really blame them because like so many stories do that, right? It's like Lord of the Rings could not have been resolved without Frodo, and you know, Star Wars couldn't have without Luke Skywalker and those sorts of things. Hero myths exist for a reason, I guess. Hard to escape.
There's definitely some satisfaction to it, I guess, but yeah, I don't think it paid off what it was putting down at the start of the game. I'm curious what you thought about the structure. That was the one other thing I took away in terms of, like, compared to Persona, where this lets you max out every relationship fairly easily, and like you have a lot more flexibility, and it's much more open-ended in how you can go about your day. It doesn't have that tight restriction. I found myself surprisingly missing some of the restrictions. I thought it was just, I felt a bit too grindy, just going through the motions of maxing out everything by the end, and I wanted a little more momentum pushing me in a particular direction.
I guess I gelled with the lack of restrictions, I guess you want to call it. For me, my problem with maxing out the relationship bonds in the other Persona games is that I wasn't really motivated to, especially outside of my main crew of characters. You know, in Persona 4 and 5, which is the ones I have most familiarity with, a bit of 3, I played the new Reloaded version a bit. It all depends on which characters you like. And if you only like a third of the characters, then it's a real chore to max out the relationship links in the remaining ones. And I guess with this cast of characters, I ended up liking more of them. I thought they were more varied, their backstories were more interesting, the places they were coming from, whether they were like in society or race or culture, were more interesting. And there were fewer of those like wayside characters that I had no interest in pursuing. So for that reason, I felt naturally motivated to complete the social links, just to hear more story, quite honestly, and to get some of the mechanical benefits. So I guess you could say I don't have a strong feeling about it, but I think this game must have done it better in some ways because I actually did it. I actually completed most of the links.
So yeah, there is definitely a more diverse range of stories and characters you're going to come across. Most of them are hits, but there are definitely some are more forgettable than others.
Yeah, I feel like the Persona games, like, they focus too much on who you want to romance and things like
that. Yeah, and your teacher and the hot nurse and like
and tying that to like the story and also tying it to the mechanics of which personas get buffed is like a little bit. They're at odds
with each other. Rather than just letting you follow what seems to be the most interesting storyline.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I gave up or walked away from Persona 5 a while ago after the first two dungeons, and I don't know if I'll go back, but it's some... Maybe I will. Part of me wonders how the rest of that game plays.
I've dropped that one twice, partly because I was I felt obliged to like follow a guide to maximize everything, and in hindsight I think I would have had more fun if I just like followed where I was, followed my interest rather than feel like I wanted to have to max out everything. So I don't know, I think it's shifted my relationship to friction in games a little bit.
Yeah, and I played Persona 4 Golden on Vita, actually, very obsessively, and really, really super enjoyed that game, but I ended up getting, like, a bad ending, and I felt kind of burned by that, so... I like Persona, but I don't love it for a lot of its frustration points like that.
I will say, this might be a little blasphemous, but I had similar complaints with Final Fantasy Tactics, at least in the combat complaints, that is, in the sense of giving you this wide open system that you can experiment and mix and match all these different classes, and then you get to the end and find this very prescriptive system. Well, you have to fight this boss with this combination, or otherwise you're probably not going to have a good time. So I felt like the balance of some of the combat, both in Metaphor and Final Fantasy Tactics, didn't quite pay off that sandbox of the combat system that it set up. So yeah, I was a little disappointed with that, both of those. I don't know if we'll get back to Final Fantasy Tactics at some point, but had to throw out that comment in there.
I would like to. So put a pin in that. We'll revisit it. I mean, I have to finish Tactics, so I would like to revisit it at some point.
See, that was I was trying to think of what the other game that I had to kick down to easy at the very end, and it was that one.
There you go. So you're good for games. Shall we move on to dessert?
Yes. Then? Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. All right. Well, so I've been talking a lot. Do you want to cover your item?
Yeah, just quickly. I mean, because mostly I've been watching more Columbo and Mission Impossible, to be honest. They're not particularly diverse media consumption here. So I just wanted to quickly talk about a book that I haven't finished yet, about halfway through, and am really enjoying. It's called The Tainted Cup by Robert Jackson Bennett. So I haven't read a lot of traditional fantasy for a while. I've mostly shifted towards sci-fi. I think I burnt out on reading a lot of pretty tropey high fantasy stuff, and most of the more modern, like Brandon Sanderson, hasn't really done it for me. So this is the first one I've read in a while. It does have a few twists on the sort of fantasy genre, though, in that we see a lot of claims of punk in various genres. Like, you've got your steampunk, your solar punk, your hope punk, or so many of these now, and a lot of those don't necessarily feel earned. It's like calling something core, basically. But this does actually feel like one of the more punk elements of subgenre, basically. And then it's basically, I used to call it like flora punk or something. Like, there's basically alchemists who are able to do body modification by various means. Like, some of it's related to trees. Like, there's basically biogenetic modifications to various plants and trees, but also to bodies. It's like, some people are made to be super soldiers, some are... The main character basically has a modification that lets him have perfect memory recall. Like, he smells a certain scent and he can associate that with memories, and he uses that as a... He's basically Watson to another character's Sherlock, essentially. It is a murder mystery that eventually ties into a larger conspiracy. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to pay off yet, but that's the main draw so far, is like solving this murder mystery. But I did find all of this body modification to be quite interesting, and it's playing also with some sort of themes of neurodivergence, like both in characters who are and aren't modified and how they think differently. I think it's playing with those in some interesting ways and comparing to some of the different modes of thinking, essentially. So I'm not sure how exactly it's going to pay off, but so far what it's set down has been really interesting. The backdrop is also kaiju roaming around, like this giant wall surrounding the whole empire to block out these kaiju, and it's the wet season, so it means that more of them are about to attack. So it's laying down a lot of checks. Not sure if it's going to pay them all off. We'll see, but I'm really enjoying it so far. It's got a few fascinating twists on the fantasy genre.
Very cool. I don't have a lot of in-depth history with fantasy novels myself. I've always leaned more on the sci-fi side, but you know, I have a begrudging respect for fantasy, and I feel like I should read more, especially of the important pieces. I really tried with, The Wheel of Time, and that first book is boring as hell.
I mean, I love The Wheel of Time. To be fair, I was 14, and it was my first big fantasy series. I didn't have a point of comparison, so that it was largely reading a lot of those sort of things that I eventually burnt out. But there is a lot, divergence within the fantasy genre of subgenres, different forms of prose and themes to explore there. So yeah, lots of different flavors of fantasy. One thing I did wanted to clarify is, like, one thing that isn't very punk is that most of the modifications in this world are sort of seem to be controlled by the government or the empire, like for their super soldiers or for their investigators. There's hints that it's sort of going to subvert that and some sort of rebellion, perhaps. I'm curious if that's going to pay off. Obviously, like, yeah, cyberpunk, you want to be in the shadows and with all the underground, I guess, rather than working for the empire. So curious to see how they're going to subvert that, but enjoying it so far.
Very cool. Okay, I am going to mention a book, not a novel this time, but I'm going to be mentioning a nonfiction book. And probably not a surprise, because I've already mentioned like 5 or 6 times already this episode, I finally finished Fight, Magic, Items by Aidan Mohair, who is a local, I believe, or at least a Vancouver Island.
On the island, I think, resident. Yeah.
Yeah. So, fellow Canadian and a fellow lover of JRPGs. Must be around my age or in between our ages, because he kind of grew up playing the same sorts of games I did. So this is very, very familiar territory. And as a result, I really enjoyed reading his book. So I'll talk about the format, and then I'm going to ask you your thoughts, because I know you read it as well. So the format is, you know, mostly historical. This is a nonfiction, like I said, but it does, like a lot of history books do, it weaves in personal stories, narratives, and the author pretty liberally bakes in sort of like, you know, where he was at when he was starting to play this game, or like the little anecdote about picking up this title from the game store, having to drive in from the Victoria, from the island down to Vancouver to pick up this console or whatever at a certain time. And, you know, those touch points, while probably unnecessary in a lot of ways, I enjoyed, mostly because it speaks to me as a person of roughly that age, also living around here. You know, I think kind of helps to ground the facts, because history is not always about facts. Oftentimes it's about people, and it's about histories, it's about emotions and sensations and feelings, whether about the subject matter or the author. So I think that it's generally not a problem to include those personal aspects of it. And then about the historical side, like I said, this book, almost 70 or 80% of it is about Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, and about the creators of it, Hironobu Sakaguchi for Final Fantasy, and Yuji Horii for Dragon Quest. And subsequent versions of the games will come out from different directors or whatnot. And there's, of course, a large supporting crew of creators who helped to make these series, not just the one genius behind it. But the book definitely kind of centers those individuals a lot. And I was very pleased to see that there were at least 2 or 3 chapters dedicated to the late Rieko Kodama, who was involved in the creation of the Final Fantasy series. So that had a decent
Fantasy Star series,
that's right. So that had a big chunk of the book dedicated to it as well. What are your thoughts about the book, Daniel?
Yeah, it's been a few months since I read it. I did discuss it in detail on the podcast. I seem to recall it. I mean, there's been a lot of these books that can tend to be a comprehensive history of the genre. This is by far not particularly comprehensive. There are a lot of gaps. It is the genre through a very specific lens of, you know, growing up in, you know, Western Canada in this time period, essentially. It is a particular niche lens into the genre. It's one that happens to line up pretty well with me and my experience. I mean, even me growing up in Australia, my experience of JRPGs there was quite different, but it's still relatively close in age range there. And largely, I think, in terms of experience too, because I think if you have played a lot of JRPGs, this is probably going to be pretty much a lot of common knowledge, essentially. It'd be enjoyable for the nostalgia of just listing off all the ones you're familiar with. For me, not being as familiar with the genre, I found it engaging and just spotting some spots where I wanted to dig into further. It's one that really kickstarted me into trying Phantasy Star for the first time, and a few other more niche series in the genre that I've been wanting to try. So yeah, I think it is a particularly, like I said, it is a very niche look, but one that happened to align with my particular level of experience.
Yeah, and I pretty much have to agree with you there, is that this book, despite it being somewhat lengthy, I think it was like 300 pages or 300 to 400 pages or something like that, it was not exhaustive. Like I said, it mostly covered those two series, and it was published a few years ago, so it's not even like the very, very latest stuff. That can't blame that. They can't read the future tea leaves of what's going on. But it mostly covered those two series with little jaunts into secondary RPGs like Phantasy Star, which I was pleased that they went there. But you're right, it did cover a lot of things that I knew, and maybe that's good for people, that it fills in context for things that everyone kind of thought that they knew. Maybe it went into depth like, no, there were these additional people who contributed these qualities to these games, or, like I previously mentioned, kind of just cultural or historical or even technical limitations on why some of these decisions were made. Maybe those aren't well known to everyone. So it's nice that it gets spelled out at some point. But you might want to turn to some other sources for more in-depth look at those less popular JRPG series. I was really hoping for more info on series that I'm not super familiar with myself, like, you know, games that did come out here or in English eventually, like Ark of the Lad, Breath of Fire, the Tales series, the Trails series, East,
yeah.
All those games were mentioned in little, like, tiny, tiny little call-outs, or maybe, like, half of a page, or at most half of a chapter were devoted to some of those lesser-known series, and I personally wanted to know more about them, because they're sort of gaps in my experience.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I having not played many Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest games, like, That was particularly interesting as a primer through those series, but that using those as a launching pad for the weirder, more obscure stuff is where I'd like to dig into a little deeper.
Yeah, so I personally would love to see, maybe from Aidan Moher himself, a follow-up that covers some of those lesser-known titles. Or if you just can't wait that long, go check out that catalog YouTube series and learn more about East, learn more about Shin Megami Tensei, learn more about Phantasy Star, and also get to see more. Like, this is a book. It doesn't have, other than some attractive artwork, it has a great cover featuring Alice from Phantasy Star herself as the one kind of figured character on the cover. Very, very attractive. Those aforementioned YouTube videos I mentioned have a lot more visuals, so that might appeal to those who are more visually oriented. So I think Fight Magic Items is still well worth reading. I enjoyed it to bits, and it's not so academic or stuffy either. It's very, very kind of like readable.
I did see there's in the last couple of weeks, there's been a big story, but sort of biography coming out about Rieko Kodama on, what's the website? VG Densetsu. I haven't had a chance to look at that yet, but I've been looking forward to digging into it, especially because I also just happened to finish Phantasy Star 4. I'll be talking about next episode, I think.
Yeah, I'm really kind of mad at myself, jealous of you. It seems like you're just like lapping me on some of these game series that I have been...
Good luck to catch up on.
I've been part of my life for a long time. You're just kind of blazing past me.
On I am very unemployed, Mark, so that's fair.
Okay, fine. That's going to be my excuse to not feel too bad about it. I do have to get through those games eventually. Anyways, Fight Magic Items. It's been a very JRPG-heavy episode, but it's well worth reading, and it's subject matter that's dear to my heart.
Excellent. I promise there is board game talk coming soon. I have been playing some solo board games.
There you go. And we have like RPGs to cover that we have played ourselves or read ourselves. And there's a certain little card game that we're going to be touching upon soon enough, as long as we can get some in-person plays to happen. Okay, Daniel, what do you think? Shall we leave it there?
I think that's the game. Let's close it up. If you have any questions or comments on today's games, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. Check out our videos on YouTube. We put out video episodes of everyone that we record. If you want to listen to some of our earlier episodes, I don't know if our episode on Guardians of the Galaxy was on video yet.
I don't think so.
If you do want to check out our older episodes. They are available in audio form at the podcatcher of your choosing. Do check us out there. We'd love to hear your feedback about games that you enjoyed, games that we did and you didn't. We want to hear your feedback and input. It really motivates us to keep putting these things out. If you want to reach out to me directly, you can, at me at Blue Sky. I'm on Blue Sky as Mark USA, MarkYuasa at bsky.social. And yourself, Daniel.
You can find me at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast, and you can find the Omnigamer Club account there as well.
Very cool. Anything you want to plug?
No. I think we will be taking a break sometime over the holidays. We'll decide when exactly that's going to be, and we'll be posting on Blue Sky, I'm sure, when we have more news. So, thank you, Mark. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember to have a balanced diet of games. Bye.
Bye.